Greetings, Earth Explorers. Welcome to X Squared Radio, where the past meets the future. I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. In here, the results are always positive. We explore the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. Whether you are driving across the country tonight or listening on the web while you're working on your favorite project, you are about to learn more about who we are and why we are here and what we may become than you thought possible. We might go a little past your imagination, but have no fear. You will be safely traveling with us. Keep your arms inside the vehicle, recline your chair, and look out the window as we launch X Squared Radio. Welcome to 2011. So glad that you made it this far. If you want to be part of the program tonight, you're totally welcome to do so by calling 530-413-4040. Don't know what happened. We lost the signal. Ah, well, we're back, just like that. And that's what's so beautiful about internet radio. We have these little snafus, and you get to listen to them sort of like bloopers. If you want to join the program, it's 530-413-4511 or 530-413-4513. Every once in a while, somebody trips over the extension cord. That's okay. We come back. The solar wind tonight is 354 kilometers per second, and the proton count is an average 3.5. Wouldn't worry about it too much. Besides, not many of you are going to be going out in short sleeves today anyway. It's pretty cold across the nation, pretty wet in some places, and records being set everywhere. There is a solar wind that will arrive on the 4th, so be ready for that, you high-latitude sky watchers. U.S. Department of Defense polar orbiting satellites are observing bright bands of auroral light circling the North Pole. Quoted as saying, it shows the sinuous path of the energetic particles entering Earth's upper atmosphere. These sinuous bands could descend south over Europe and parts of North America around January 3rd, that's tomorrow, when a solar wind stream is expected to hit Earth's magnetosphere. High-latitude sky watchers, be alert. If they're right, it sounds like these energetic bands are dancing around the poles of the Earth. Interesting stuff. Fits a lot of theories that we've had over the years. Strong support from the White House and U.S. Congress will allow NASA to lay the groundwork for a vigorous and extensive Earth science program that includes 16 major missions scheduled for launch between 2011 and 2021, an agency official said. NASA plans to launch 3 Earth science satellites in 2011. The GLORI Climate Monitoring Satellite in February, the joint U.S.-Argentina Aquarius Sea Surface Salinity Mission in June, and the National Polar Orbiting Operational Environment Satellite Preparatory Project Mission in October. Now, one might wonder why these three and why the sudden increase in funding when just a year ago Obama was saying, oh, that old space program, I've got better use for the money than that. Well, now they've suddenly and unexpectedly increased NASA's budget by billions of dollars in order to launch these 3 science satellites. Well, let's think about it for a second. The GLORI Climate Monitoring Satellite is obviously, well, at least from my observation, obviously, to keep up with the extreme weather that we have been seeing. And we're going to talk about that in our first hour tonight. What causes it? Why it is occurring? And perhaps are we involved or not involved in that? The second is the Argentine Aquarius Sea Surface Salinity Mission. That monitors the amount of salinity in the ocean. Why is that important? Because as the polar caps melt, and as the atmospheric river of water that flows around our Earth dumps more and more fresh water into the oceans, the salinity begins to drop in the seas. When that happens, the ocean does not shed heat as easily as it once did. It warms, it changes thermally. And when it does, the types of sea life that grow in it change, and the movement of underwater rivers changes. Now, the Gulf Stream has been monitored now for about 25 years, and it has not changed, not in velocity, not in movement. And so preliminary worries that the Gulf Stream would be flowing further and further out into the Atlantic, making it harder and harder for U.S. fishermen to capture the sea life that moves with that Gulf Stream, are unfounded. So those fears are being laid to rest. But is 25 years long enough to look at a body the size of the ocean? Five-sevenths of the Earth is water. And as this water changes temperature, its ability to affect weather changes. The more fresh water you have in the sea, the more water can evaporate from the sea, and it goes up and forms clouds. Now, I don't know if you watched this weather pattern recently around Christmas time in the northeast of the United States. Many, many times these weather patterns form off the East Coast, and they form about half or three quarters of what looks like, strangely, a hurricane. And just before Christmas, we looked at a weather pattern, and sure enough, the entire hurricane had formed. Now, did we have the 150, 200 mile an hour winds that are associated with hurricane patterns near the equator? No. But the formation was there, the movement was there, the counterclockwise movement, and the entire circle of moisture was there. There was enough moisture in the air to form that weather pattern. This is what is changing. This is why the GLORI Climate Monitoring Satellite is being launched. This is why the Sea Surface Salinity Mission is being launched. And the strangest of all, one that we really thought we would not see, at least in the next 10 years, certainly must be linked to its importance with upcoming 2012 and the alignment with the galactic plane. And that is the National Polar Orbiting Operational Environment Satellite. Now, keep in mind, this is a preparatory project. This is a base satellite. This is one that is going to form the beginning of a series of satellites that are designed to monitor the poles of the Earth. They're not exploring space, my friends. They're exploring our own planet, and they're doing it in an expedited manner with unprecedented funding. Just wanted to let you know. The U.S. Space Agency also is planning to launch, in December of 2012, the Landsat Data Continuity Mission. This will shore up an aging land mapping fleet, followed in July 2013 by initial launch for the Global Precipitation Measurement Mission. That's to measure rainfall accurately all around the planet, places where we don't have rain gauges. And this is a joint effort with the Japanese Aerospace Exploration Agency to deploy a constellation of rainfall-measuring satellites. We want to know what's going on the Earth. We want to know where is rain falling and why. And we intend to collect enough data to make some predictions on that. It seems strange that they would wait all the way to December 2012. Maybe they think they can figure something out by then. By the way, the Landsat data mission, those of you that buy maps still or use Google Map or MapQuest or have any other of the hard copy maps that are made, these are made from satellite pictures. Everything from the location of oil wells on a map, all your geotechnical maps, including elevations and everything, are all done by satellite now, right down to the square meter. And if you've ever gone to Google Maps or Google Earth and you've tried to look at various sections of the country, in some areas of the country, you know, you can zoom right down to the little swimming pool in the backyard. And in others, you get to about 10,000 feet, 15,000 feet, and it just pixelates out. The data isn't there. The full spectrum of data isn't there. The strange thing is, it's not where you would expect. You see, the rural areas are in quite a lot of detail sometimes. And the city areas are not in so much detail. It's exactly backwards of what you would expect. And that is exactly right. The publicly available information is low resolution. The resolution data that's available to the government, however, is very high resolution. And recently there was an argument over who was going to have access to that high resolution data. In fact, the Pentagon made a protest in Congress that they were not being given access to the high-resolution Earth observation imagery. According to Congress, Pentagon can have access down to 3 to 5 meter resolution. The only reason that Congress would make such a rule is if they actually had the ability to look closer, more refined than 3 to 5 meters. The strange thing is, why wouldn't the Pentagon have access to that data? And who would have access to that data? That's the thing to think about. And if you have thoughts about that, I want you to join me tonight. We're starting off the new year very inquisitory about what's going on relative to who's watching us, and about also what we're spending our time, our energy, our money, our concentration, our worry, what we're stressing about, and is it relevant really to the progress of the human race? And we're this year going to weave this into a year-long theme of how the human race will blend with perhaps other races which are here on the earth. Notice I did not say which may be here. In 2010, we're pretty well convinced, given the long string of experts that we've had on this program, not only are we being visited, we have people staying over. We have company, as we say in the South. We have company. And really don't know how we're treating them. We do know that we're pretty well convinced that they're as visible as they want to be. Believe me, if ETs wanted to be more visible than they are, they could be, with complete impunity, I might add. So they are what they are, and maybe they're waiting for us. Maybe they're waiting for a specific moment, a rendezvous, maybe reinforcements. Who knows? Maybe the arrival of a late guest or a guest race that may be late in coming. Interesting things to consider. As we consider the rest of the news, there were 23 earthquakes in the last 24 hours with 5 over 5.0. One in Chile measured 7.1. So a couple of commercials and we'll get into our first hour. Remembering the future, the physics of the soul and time travel, as you now know, reached the rank of number 4 on Amazon. We're happy about that. We want to keep the sales going. You thousands and thousands of people that bought the book, please tell a friend about it. We have uploaded a new edition. It should go live in about 4 or 5 days. Some of the typos have been fixed. A couple more paragraphs have been added. Some more information that's pertinent. I didn't want to fatten up the book because it's just about the right size. You can read it in a couple of afternoons. The audio book is pretty good. Got great reviews on that. And we have also uploaded new Nook and Kindle versions. So those of you that have had formatting problems with paragraphs overlapping, and we just weren't familiar with the Kindle coding. We were Kindle gardeners, and now we know how Kindle changes pages and things like that. So we've fixed that code, and it should be a much smoother transition. So those of you that have it on Kindle, recommend it to your friends, and let's keep it going. We have to get this message out there in order to have its effect and be able to move the planet in a different direction. If you missed the offer on Coast to Coast AM with George Noory, there isn't much I can do about that except I can extend it. So I will continue to give away the audiobook for anyone who buys the hard copy book from the website rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. Put it on your Facebook, send it out to your friends. If they're not great readers, don't worry about it. I read it for you. So all you have to do is sit back and listen, turn the pages if you want to, put the book on your shelf and say, I have a copy of it. Of course, all the illustrations are in there. I am thinking about putting all the illustrations because in color they're quite magnificent, especially the ones that I drew. Not that I'm a great artist, but you want to see the colors. You want to see what's going on. The text is okay in its description, but a picture's worth, well, you understand. So if you want to see the color images, I will upload them to the website. Just email me, brooksagnew@yahoo.com or bagnew@x2-radio.com. All my contact information is at x2radio.com. I also want to extend the invitation to any of you out there that would like to have me come and speak in your area. Now, it doesn't mean that you have to have a big conference or anything like that. These little salons, you know, 10 or 20 people, not very many. The rates are extremely reasonable, allow you to make a little jingle off of it. Pull some friends together. I'll be happy to fly or drive to your location and give you a couple of hours of multimedia presentation and stick around for a couple more hours and answer questions, and we'll even have a meditation workshop. February 3rd through 5th, Maureen St. Germain, my teacher, is going to be putting on a training workshop in Concord, North Carolina, February 3rd through 5th. Those of you that are interested, please go to rememberingthefuturebook.com, click on the link for registering for this extremely affordable three-day workshop, or you can go to maureenstgermain.com, maureenstgermain.com. The link is also at X Squared Radio and at rememberingthefuturebook.com. And sign up for that workshop. I would love to meet you. I think you would love to perfect this meditation. It works very well. It's for busy people like me. And in 17 breaths, you're in. And then you learn the 18th breath. Trust me, learning how to breathe like this, learning how to orient the energy of your body with the energy that surrounds you will connect you most likely with memories of the past and the future. And you'll be able to bring that information to the present, empower yourself, and take control of the quality of your life. That's what we're here to do. All right, 40 seconds. We will begin with the first hour of X Squared Radio. Don't go away. Also, lest I forget, my good friend Dr. John Turner neurosurgeon from Hawaii, wrote a magnificent book on medicine and miracles. You have to read it. You just simply have to read it. As you grow older, you're going to have more infirmities. This book will really change the way you look at the health of your body. Go back and listen to the archive, Dr. John Turner. It's out there on xsquaredradio.com. It's also on bbsradio.com. And pick up his book on medicine and miracles. The link is on the website. Dr. John Turner. Tonight is the first program of X Squared Radio's sixth year on the air with BBS Radio Network. Now, you know, X Squared Radio is kind of a strange story, how it came about, how it got started. I dabbled a little bit in radio when I was in high school. It's when I discovered I actually had a Scottish accent. People have been telling me for years, but hey, you know, you're a kid. You can't hear what's coming out of your mouth until you put a set of headphones on and put your mouth in front of a microphone. Then you realize you have an accent. So I began to work that out, and what came out is the voice that you hear today. Well, long story short, approached in 2001 by my good friend and co-author, pen named E.J. Clark, to help author a set of nonfiction books on the creation and destiny of the Earth called The Ark of Millions of Years. It's now turned into three Amazon and Barnes & Noble best-selling books. The fourth just went to the publisher, should be out in about a month. This is the update one, covering all of the predictions that we made in the first three books that have actually come true, exactly as we mapped it out. And there are some left, so we have a pretty good track record going from the ancient mysteries, linking them with absolutely leading-edge physics, and telling the story to you. I had no idea that you were interested in this kind of stuff. We published it in November of 2004, and by March of 2005, Volume 1 was a national bestseller. The next thing you know, I was doing radio interviews, and one of those exposed me to a person who introduced me to my producer, Don Newsom, and BBS Radio Network. He said, how would you like to have your own radio program? I said, well, gee, sounds kind of novel. Sure. So we got 1 hour on Wednesday nights back in 2005 in September. And that lasted a very short time. No, it didn't fail. Quite the opposite. We didn't have enough time, and we were on the wrong night. So we moved to Sunday nights, 3 hours between 8 and 11 Eastern time, 5 and 8 Pacific time, and the rest is internet radio history. If you put paranormal internet talk radio into Google, X Squared Radio comes up number one. If you go to BBS Radio Network, you will see the largest collection of non-mainstream thinkers and hosts from around the world in one place on the internet. And BBS Radio consistently measures in the top 100,000 websites on the web. On the web, that's, you know, where Google and Yahoo and Bing and all the other guys are, YouTube. Yeah, BBS Radio's up there. So on that network, X Squared Radio is one of the top radio programs on that network. We consistently stay there because we strive for once a week for 3 hours to bring you the best imagination in sound that we possibly can. Explorations into the mysteries of the universe and of the earth. And we involve you. We invite your calls. We invite your chats on Skype, because we are live on Skype. So this is an interactive talk radio program like nothing else out there. There is nothing on regular radio, AM or FM, anywhere in the world where you can have real-time access with a global message at one time than this network. You can do it here because Don and Doug have poured their hearts and souls into this. And by the way, if you think you have what it takes to be a host, contact me, and I will do what I can to sponsor you and get you your own talk radio program. If you think you have a message to say and you can hang in there, it isn't as easy as it looks or sounds. And I would encourage you to do so because it's a great experience. So that is how X Squared Radio came to pass. How did it get its name? Why is it not called the Brooks Agnew Show? The answer is simple. The show is not about me. The show is about the mysteries. It's about the universe. It's about the message. It's about the authors that come on this program. I facilitate them to come here and tell their complete story. Do I attack them? No. Do I conflict with them? Not very often. I come here with enough education and enough engineering experience to allow them to flesh out their thoughts here where they cannot do it on any other talk radio program in the world. I'm not a broadcast expert playing a scientific expert. I'm a scientific expert playing as a broadcast expert. So it's a big difference. You get the highest quality right here because of the function, the mathematical function of X squared. Y, the result, is equal to X squared. Every number put into X squared comes out positive. That's why we're here. That's why we turn sometimes the most conspiratorial dark messages into something hopeful, something that you can grab onto and take into the week with you to defeat those things that hold you back from the glory that you can become. Now, there is one number that you can put in there. Yes, I know. It is an imaginary number called I. It is the square root of -1. So that's why I am not the feature of the program. Yes, the producers would like me to be. They would like it to be called the Brooks Agnew Show. They would like it to be brooksagnew.com. I'm sorry. I'm uncomfortable with that. So we leave it as X Squared Radio. I'm the host. And you are not only listening, but you're also invited anytime you like to be the guest. Call me anytime we're live between 8 and 11 Eastern, 5 and 8 Pacific, at 530-413-4511, and let's talk. I know there are thousands of you out there because you write me, because you buy the books, because you tell me that you heard about the books, or you heard about the message, or you heard some author on this program. So don't be afraid. You're safe here. You have your seatbelt on. You have your seat reclined. You're looking out the window. You're fine. Give us a call, and we'll talk. So last year at this time, in January of 2010, we were talking about the extreme display of weather all around the world. And if it was possible, 2010 blew those records away. We talked about the records from 2009. We talked about the weather weirdness of 2009. 2010 made 2009 look mild. Russia was on fire. The Western U.S. never even had a summer. They had the longest ski season in Utah in recorded history. They were skiing in July. The southern hemisphere was covered in snow. Glaciers were growing, and fresh water was being baked from the land at an unprecedented rate during the year 2010. It was the coldest year on record, going back as far as records go, over 1,000 years. They broke heat records, they broke cold records, but the average was the coolest. We had the longest heat wave in history, and then immediately afterwards had the earliest opening for ski resorts in more than 100 years. Now, we can talk about how weird the weather is. And we do, when you, those of you that have signed up for the X Squared Radio ARC newsletters, you get this. I save these stories throughout the year, and I copy and paste certain parts of the story, and then I comment on it to try to keep you aware that, you know, what you're hearing on the Weather Channel, what you're seeing on CNN or Fox, this is watered down. You're not getting the whole picture. We put it together into one report almost on a monthly basis, and you can read that. Some of you trash it, and some of you value it, so that's fine. We put it together, nevertheless, to keep you informed. Now, many of the experts, and we intend to try to get some of them, especially from the new SDO, that's the Solar Dynamic Observatory. We have relied upon SOHO for a long, long time for our solar information, and it's a little two-dimensional. It's a little flat, okay? We don't really get a lot of information from SOHO. It only looks at it from one aspect. That's often baking out when we want to get a great measurement. But the Solar Dynamic Observatory that was launched this last year, from its first images until today, has just been spectacular with the information that it's providing. It's providing more information than all the solar scientists in the world can assimilate and analyze. So rather than hide it, rather than bank it and let grad students munch on it for another decade, they just let it go to the public. See what we see is basically what they're saying. It's fabulous. It's awesome. But the solar experts, if there are any left in the world, I think most of them are standing there with their pants down around their ankles right now, thinking that they're fully clothed. But the solar experts believe that the sun is to blame for the weather. Whatever the sun is doing, that's what the atmosphere does, and that's what the weather does. What you're going to find out in this hour is quite a bit different than that. The sun has not been obeying sunspot patterns established over several millennia by observers of history. Many speculate that it is because the solar system is getting closer to the galactic plane, and that this gravitational band is what is affecting its jet stream. It could be. It could be. But what you are about to hear is a clip. Leading researchers have gathered this information. I'm going to share it with you. It's the audio. Obviously, it's a video clip. Let me make sure that the commercial doesn't come up first. Okay, here we go. This is Euro News. I want you to listen closely. Here we go.
Whether our skies are clear or cloudy could be decided by tiny particles from dying stars in galaxies far, far away. Researchers here at the Danish National Space Center in Copenhagen have found a clear link between cosmic particles deep out in space, the cycles of the sun, and changes in our planet's weather. A real breakthrough in climate research.
The sun puts out the solar wind, which is a continuous stream of plasma from the sun. This carries the sun's magnetic field out into what is known as the heliosphere, a big area of outer space that surrounds the sun. And this magnetic field in the heliosphere shields us from cosmic rays, particles, very high energy particles that originate in supernovas. Now these high energy particles has an influence on ionization in the lower atmosphere, and these in turn have an influence on the creation of clouds.
We can see that process inside this tank. High energetic particles that have passed through the sun's magnetic field then shoot down to Earth, and as they hit the atmosphere, they help create the building blocks for clouds.
What we have here is what we call a cloud chamber. And the purpose of this is really to be able to see particles that come from space. We are talking about particles that are produced by stars. It's actually dying stars. And they might have died several million years ago. When they go through, they make sort of a condensation streak, just like from a contrail from an airplane. The sun's magnetic field screens out at least half of these particles. But sometimes the sun is very active, so it's a better shield, more effective, and sometimes it relaxes and you have many more particles coming in. We believe that these particles are fundamental also in forming clouds. There is a remarkable correlation between the solar activity and changes in the Earth's climate.
Henrik's team is exploring the link between the Earth's climate and what is known as space weather.
Space weather is really a chain of processes originating at the Sun and propagating through interplanetary space, interaction with the Earth's magnetic field, and then finally the effect down to the atmosphere.
The Earth's magnetic field acts as a buffer against solar storms. Gusts of solar wind can dump particles into the atmosphere, creating the auroras around the poles.
The magnetic field is really the controlling factor of the space environment. It's very important. Electric currents are generated. It's electromagnetic interaction, so strong electric currents are generated in our atmosphere and in the space environment. And they create magnetic fields, which we can see with the satellites.
Space weather can cause problems for modern technology. European Space Agency has two missions aimed at understanding the Sun's effects on the Earth. SOHO detects explosions on the surface and storms heading our way. The Cluster mission comprises four spacecraft that work nearer the Earth, measuring how solar activity affects the space around our planet. They focus on the changes in the magnetosphere as it's buffeted by energy particles. We still don't fully understand the Sun, but we know it follows cycles.
If you look at it just in the normal visual light that we look at the Sun, it doesn't appear to change. You can see sunspots on the Sun, very small dark spots that fluctuates in intensity over 11-year cycles. But if you look at it in other scales, in ultraviolet or extreme ultraviolet, it actually fluctuates a lot.
During a solar storm, flashes of X-rays and ultraviolet rays take just 8 minutes to reach Earth. A few hours later, solar protons and other energetic particles arrive, followed a couple of days later by the solar wind that can pound the magnetosphere.
If you're a spacecraft, you are in space and you are embedded in this radiation environment. And if the radiation gets intense, the spacecraft can be destroyed or disrupted.
It's a hazardous environment for spacecraft and satellites. We need to learn to predict space weather if we're going to explore the solar system.
There was a huge solar eruption in 1972 in August. Now in April and in December, there was two Apollo missions with astronauts walking on the surface of the moon. The moon does not have a protective magnetic field. The moon does not have a protective atmosphere, so this radiation just goes down to the surface. And had there been astronauts at the surface, walking around at the surface of the moon at that time, they would really have been very, very sick and maybe even killed.
Space weather is not only a threat to man-made objects in orbit. In the longer term, it could also affect our climate. As the Sun changes, so does the number of cloud-promoting particles reaching our atmosphere.
If we look at history, we can see that there has been large changes in these particles arriving at Earth. And when that happened, climate changed, and there has been large changes. Really, we had the Little Ice Age, as you probably know, from around 1300 until 1850, a very cold period. That was a period where many more particles was coming into the atmosphere, and it made more clouds. Clouds actually cool the Earth's atmosphere and give you a colder climate.
Until recently, it was thought that space weather and Earth weather were entirely separate. Jens Olaf Petzke-Pedersen wants to prove the wider extent to which solar cycles affect our climate.
We are the Space Research Institute, and much of what we do at the Space Institute is look out towards space and look at the stars and planets and what's going on in the solar system. And I think it's very interesting that apparently there's also something, there's a link between what goes on in space and what happens on Earth. So it's not isolated spheres. And also the climate system of the Earth is not an isolated system. It does interact with the outer space. And I think that's a very intriguing idea and worthwhile to investigate.
All right, so there you have it. That's the report from Euronews. Now, there are a couple things in there I want you to pay close attention to. One was the assumption, and these are some of the top solar scientists in the world. As I said, maybe they are experts, and maybe their pants are down around their ankles. They said space weather is seen as interaction between the sun and the Earth. Well, what we're going to reveal to you in the next 10 minutes or so is quite a different story, because it may not just be the sun. In fact, it may not be the sun at all. And maybe the sun is an intermediary. But as you can see from this clip, the leading researchers have gathered enough information about the ionization of the lower atmosphere, that's where we live, to see a relationship between the type and level of ionization and the formation of clouds. That much is a symptom. That's a leading indicator of what's going on in space. Cloud formation or not formation is the most accurate trigger for these weather extremes. As you heard him describe, a mini ice age between the years 1300 and 1850, it was quite cold. They assume, of course, they didn't have any cloud chambers then to measure, but they assume it's because the sun was very active and pouring lots of high energy particles and energy into the Earth, and this was causing ionization in the lower atmosphere, causing ions to clump together and form particles, aggregating water together and forming clouds, thus blocking or absorbing a lot of the infrared energy that comes to the Earth and actually warms the water and the soil upon which we walk, and that causes the weather to change. Now, they support the idea that we have been saying in our books for years that this neighborhood has a swarm of high-energy particles that are bombarding the heliosphere from the outside. What is unknown is why the sun isn't fighting back as it has done for billions of years, as it did in recent hundreds of years. Then we discovered a very strange phenomenon we call space quakes. Yeah, space quakes. We thought that the bursts of gamma radiation would line up with the galactic plane, but they weren't. Einstein was wrong. There was evidence that high-powered gamma bursts were entering our space, but perhaps from another dimension. The explosions were discovered to be so large that it defied all known physics. Now, this next clip might be a little bit alarming. I doubt that you've heard it before. It's not one of those clips that's you know, highly listened to. I think that you'll be interested in it. These explosions, let's see, let me get past this little advertisement here. These explosions are so powerful, and we did expect them to line up with the galactic plane. After all, we're getting very close to it. We're a little less than 2 years away from this now. So as we near it at the rate of 18.5 miles per second, that's the rate at which our planet moves through the solar system around our sun. But our solar system is moving also as we revolve. So this clip is where they tried to measure the origin of where these space quakes were popping into our dimension, our area of the neighborhood. Now, keep in mind, this is not a deep space probe. This is a local probe. And this is what they picked up. I think you'll find it interesting. BBC, here we go.
Thank you. 1991, NASA launched the BATSY satellite. Equipped with state-of-the-art detectors, it was going to study the bursts in detail for the first time. But as the data came in, a disturbing picture began to emerge. What they'd expected was that the bursts would line up with the galactic plane, meaning they were coming from within our own galaxy.
The first dozen or so gamma ray bursts weren't lining up with the galaxy. The next dozen or so also weren't lining up with the galaxy, but they happened to be randomly distributed throughout the sky.
Once again, the first thoughts of the scientists were that someone must have made a mistake.
I think the immediate reaction was perhaps a little bit of disbelief that they must be doing something wrong. And of course, ourselves, we were worried about that and worried about it every night when we tried to sleep.
And yet, as every day went by, more and more bursts appeared all over the sky.
We said, well, this is going to cause a lot of waves, but we better go public with this announcement that it looks like the gamma ray bursts are uniformly distributed throughout the sky.
There was now no doubt. Baczynski had been right all along.
I think that was professionally the most joyous moment in my life, because all of a sudden I realized that something which was very risky, which could work either way, turned out my way. So, of course, I was very, very happy.
But Baczynski's triumph threatened to plunge science into chaos. If the bursts were coming from beyond our galaxy, then they had to be caused by something far bigger than science could explain.
If they were really coming from distant galaxies, it was a phenomenon unlike anything we've seen before. The amount of energy release, the rate of energy release, was greater than anyone had ever seen before in any other form. And the details of how you got that, nobody could understand how that could be. It was pressing the limits of our understanding.
It was now clear that these explosions were of an almost inconceivable size. So big, in fact, that they might even be violating Einstein's fundamental law, E equals mc squared.
And now you see why solar scientists are baffled. These are senior scientists. They've been studying the sun for 40, some of them 45 and 50 years, and they're scared. They're kept up late at night. They're worried. Not only were they worried about what was going on, they were worried about reporting what was going on. They didn't understand how this much energy could be bursting into our corner of the neighborhood from not one place, like along the galactic plane, the way we expected, but from all over, outside the galaxy. Now, as you know, when an energy bursts out in space, theoretically, what it's supposed to do is go 360 degrees in all directions. Thus, the amount of energy that's transferred, gravity, energy, whatever, diminishes with the square of the distance, because it's a spherical expansion, right? So it's going to be a pi function. It's going to diminish with the square of that radius. Well, it's not. It's focused. Or it is actually entering our neighborhood from another dimension. This is supported by evidence that's collected from the Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory in Hanford, Washington, where I interviewed Dr. Fred Robb, who is the physicist that runs that that organization. Let's go ahead and take a quick break. Grab something cold to drink. It's about we'll take about a 4-minute break. Listen to a little piano from David Acton, and we'll be right back with more X Squared Radio. We'll finish this. Solar weather, maybe. Space weather, absolutely. What neighborhood are we in, after all? We'll be right back with more X Squared Radio after this. Just tuning in to X Squared Radio, I'm your host, Brooks Agnew. And we're glad that you came with us. We're coming to you live, by the way, from down here in Mississippi. So what I'm trying to do now is figure out why my recording software is not working. I may have to in this process. Let me start this. I'm not exactly sure why it's doing this. We'll stay live with you. There we go. Let's see here. Processes, services, applications. I have some, you know, technical difficulties at the moment. I don't want to keep going with the program unless I have a way to record it for you. You can listen to it, of course, by accessing the archives at bbsradio.com. But if you're not a regular listener to X Squared Radio, we would love you to listen to the archives. You can become a regular archive listener simply by going to xsquaredradio.com and signing up for the archives. It is a very simple process. $2.50 will get you a month's worth of access. $20 will get you a year's worth of access, and that's less than a bag of popcorn each month for access to almost 1,000 hours of the best experts on the planet talking about the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. We bring them here for you live. We talk about their books. We talk about their research. And that's the kind of quality that we bring you. And it's a pleasure to do. It's a hobby. Obviously, there isn't any money in it. And it's exciting to do because I like to read the books. I like to analyze the stuff. I like to try to understand their concepts. And then I like to quiz them and get them to talk about really the depths of what it is they're trying to say in their books. So as we begin the second hour of X Squared Radio, coming to you live from an undisclosed location down here in southern Mississippi, about 80 miles from the Gulf of Mexico, a completely different climb than where we were last year. And we'll be down here for a few months, and then who knows? We'll be mostly on Earth. Those of you that would like to join us this hour, we're going to finish talking about the sun and its effect on the weather, or maybe space and its effect on the weather, and just the weather weirdness that we've been having in the last couple of years, and you ain't seen nothing yet. You can join us at 530-413-4511, 530-413-4511, phone lines are open, or 530-413-4515, or you can Skype me at x2-radio.com. Just find it on, do a search for it on Skype and you'll find it. The truth is that the solar scientists know so little about these explosions, and these are very high energy gamma explosions that are focused, and we're picking them up locally with an orbiting satellite around Earth. This is not a deep space probe. And this is not what we expected to find. Maybe little ripples, little stingers out there, but nothing of this magnitude. To back calculate the actual size of these explosions almost staggers the calculator. But we can think about them, and we can ruminate about them, and I want you to. There are connections between the threads of the fabric of space-time that we are only beginning to think about. Even theoretical physicists, as you just heard, some of the most advanced solar scientists in the world are not understanding this. But I want to hear your thoughts about this. One thing is axiomatic. That is to say, this cannot be argued with or derived, really. It's an axiom from which you can derive everything else. Nothing is at rest in the universe. And the laws of motion have been explained only from a mortal point of view. Newton made observations of bodies in space and was brilliant in his assessments and imaginations about them. But space goes beyond these bodies, these gravitational densities, these frequencies of energy. Out there, in the fabric of the singularity, there are different laws. There are different forces. We would love to be able to explain them. I think we can. But we're going to have to remember something far beyond mortality. we're going to have to realize that even the most basic theories that we have assumed are true since we began thinking about space in a scientific way have to be rethought. They have to be reorganized. Now, we're pretty sure that there are torsional forces that have an effect on entangled bodies over phenomenal distances, some more than 100 billion miles, far beyond our own heliosphere, way, way out there. And, you know, this is not the kind of measurement that ordinary astronomers get to look at. There's low-hanging fruit. There's exciting stuff. And that's what most of the money is being spent on. And that's what most of the, you know, great thinkers and the famous ones are working on. But there are some out there. And there was a brilliant, brilliant series of documentaries put on this year with Morgan Freeman as the narrator. And in one of these segments, they interviewed an astronomer who took on one of these more obscure projects. She wanted something, you know, longer term, slower moving, so she didn't have to compete with the grandchildren so much. You know, she could take long-term looks at it with instruments and then collect the data and analyze it. And this is the LEO supercluster. I'm going to play this for you. It's probably a few minutes, so bear with me. But you will understand how baffling, how confused, how unsure the Astronomical and Cosmological Society is about the nature of the most basic things, like how much energy are we really being bombarded with? How do bodies actually move around the stars that they're gravitationally tied to? How do solar systems move in galaxies? How do galaxies move in clusters? How do clusters move in superclusters? Well, what you're about to hear is going to open your eyes. Here we go.
First for real hot topics.
Vera Rubin knew if she said it something sexy like black holes, other astronomers would end up beating her to publication. So instead, she began surfing the galactic backwaters.
I'm not sure I really know why I was studying galaxies, except they seemed very mysterious to me. And there was not a lot known, especially about their motions, almost nothing.
Vera first trained her telescope on the Milky Way's closest galactic neighbor, Andromeda. Like most galaxies, it had a dense central bulge of stars. She expected the billions of stars circling around this central bulge to orbit just like the planets in our solar system, obeying Isaac Newton's laws of gravity. The further away they are from the center, the slower they orbit.
This is a model of the solar system that my father built for me about 40 years ago when he retired. That shows exactly what Newton knew from his theories. Before that you're seeing here, Mercury, Venus, Earth, and Mars. Mars is going the slowest, the Earth the next slowest. Mercury is the most rapidly moving because the force of gravity is considerably less for Mars than it is for Mercury. The orbit is correspondingly slower.
This is exactly the pattern Vera expected to see when she studied stars as they orbited in their galaxies. The further from the center, the slower they should be moving. But that's not what Vera found.
It took us about 2 years to get velocities of 90 stars in the Andromeda galaxy. And the results were rather startling. We found that all of the stars were moving at the same velocity, the same number, 250 kilometers per second.
For the next few years, every galaxy Vera looked at gave her the same seemingly crazy results. All the stars, all the way to the edge of the galaxies, were moving at the same speed, completely different from the way the solar system works. The only explanation was that the force of gravity did not get weaker the further a star was from the center of a galaxy. But that could only happen if the galaxies had more mass than astronomers could see.
The explanation was that there must be very significant amounts of matter that are invisible. In fact, perhaps 90 or 95% of the material in the galaxy is invisible.
This was a truly revolutionary idea. Galaxies might be filled with an unseeable substance, something scientists could only think to call dark matter. But such a radical theory demanded ironclad evidence. Soon, dozens of astronomers were checking Vera's observations, either struggling to disprove her or scrambling to discover what or where this mysterious dark matter might be.
I did find it amazing and amusing that I had picked this field because I was interested in doing something that no one would care about. And suddenly I was involved with lots and lots of astronomers who had ideas and observations, and it was a hot topic.
Across the Atlantic in England, leading cosmologist Carlos Frank began to investigate the idea of dark matter, using not telescopes, but equations. Take Newton's laws of gravity and feed them into a highly sophisticated computer simulation. Then go for lunch.
This is the cosmology machine, a very large supercomputer whose only purpose is to simulate the universe. It's made up of 1,300 computers all working together. Even then, it takes months to complete a simulation of a small part of our universe. This is awesome computing power, almost beyond imagination, but that's what it takes if you want to emulate the universe.
Carlos started out his simulation with what scientists think the early universe was made of, a giant cloud of gas floating in empty space. Then he sat back and waited to see if his cosmology machine could build a galaxy like the ones we see.
What happens if you try to make a galaxy in a computer using simply the material that we can see? What happens is you end up with a failed galaxy. Stars form, they evolve, the biggest ones explode a supernovae, and they inject so much energy, but there just isn't enough gravity to keep these gases together. So the galaxy essentially blows itself apart. The gas dissipates, leaving very little behind. This is not how our universe is made.
So Carlos started to add dark matter to his equations. First a little, then more, and eventually five times as much of it as visible matter. After several weeks, something strange came out of the cosmology machine. Strange because it was so familiar.
This is a computer simulation of the formation of a galaxy, now with invisible dark matter and gas shown here in green. About a billion years after the Big Bang, clumps of dark matter formed. Gas fell into these clumps, turned into stars, but attracted by the force of dark matter, invisible dark matter gravity, these clumps came together, fused to build ever larger structures, so that 10 billion years later, a beautiful spiral galaxy like our own Milky Way was formed.
Carlos has shown that galaxies should form when filled with dark matter. But is there any way to prove that this is what actually happened? In Edinburgh, Scotland, Richard Massey is still trying to answer that question and is pioneering a new way of detecting dark matter. Gravitational lensing. It's all thanks to the...
Well, there you go. Gravitational lensing. Oh, that's going to be a great one. Anyway, my congratulations to them for putting this great set of documentaries together. Morgan Freeman did an outstanding job. I don't want to give credit to the channel because that's just not what we do here. But Vera is to be commended because she did a great, great work here, putting together something that, well, she thought was in obscurity and she could get some small grants for, and she could keep going and put something together that might be interesting over a lifetime of study. And what she discovered was well beyond anybody's imagination. In fact, she went beyond people's imaginations. Now, the interesting thing was the computer models. As you begin adding, and I'm going to use the term dark matter, but I want to explain that term here in just a second. As you begin adding this invisible matter, what happens is the difference between the stars and the center of the galaxy gets smaller and smaller. And so they don't go supernova. They don't collect or don't counteract each other so much. It becomes less noisy, and it becomes more of a very, very faint background kind of gravity. When that happens, the stars settle down, don't go high velocity at the center of these gravitational bodies called galaxies, the way it would be theorized like a solar system does. But they settle down and they form these nice, beautiful spirals. And sure enough, they look just exactly like the galaxies that we see out there. The spiral form, the flat form with a large, bright bulge in the middle and billions of stars around them in a nice, flat plane. That gravitational plane, the plane that we are approaching, is not formed by all of the stars and matter that we can see in the galaxy. It is more than likely formed by the gravity or by the matter that we cannot see in our galaxy. Now, interesting that they use the term dark matter, dark energy, dark matter. It's because they can't see it. It is most likely, and you've only heard that here on this program because I'm the only one that has said it. I originated it, and I would like to get it out there and get some more thoughts on it. I would like to hear your thoughts on it. But I believe that this matter is probably so bright that we cannot see it. It is well beyond the frequency detection ability of our instruments. It is in a different kind of form, perhaps a spiritual form, a higher vibrational form that doesn't resonate with the kinds of detection that we use, and perhaps it will take gravitational lensing to look at it, although no one has ever been able to lens gravity. We have been able to change its effects using high-speed rotation with heavy-mass objects, but we have not been able to lens it. If we ever do figure out how to lens it, we can collect it in a can, we can focus it out the back, and we now have a new method of propulsion. We think that gravity and energy diminish with the square of the distance between two bodies or forces because we theorize that those energies expand in a spherical manner. But what if they don't? What if they stretch over the expanse of space, not in spherical expansion, but in torsional ropes that twist and connect planets and even galaxies over incredible distances? This could explain how energy signatures are being found all over the sky, these great explosions with high energy particles appearing as a result of those explosions. Maybe those explosions are not as large as they think they are. It's just that the energy is concentrated in such a small area that what we think is only a fraction of a giant spherical picture is actually a fairly good slice of a somewhat smaller picture, more concentrated, more focused, more directed picture. This energy is not only entering our region of space, but it is bringing information as well. Yes, the orbiting satellite isn't just picking up energy. That energy is information, and that information is reaching us in volumes beyond anything any computer could analyze at this time. But we, humans, our consciousness, we are built to receive it. We're built to receive it, to analyze it, and assimilate it as we grow and remember who we are. It contains all the knowledge of the universe, past, present, future, because as I maintain, the singularity is still there. The Big Bang never happened. It is our consciousness that has added to the universe a perspective that has allowed time to exist. Otherwise, it would not. Everything would be moving at the speed of a photon, and time would be zero. It is us, it is our perspective that has created the universe and allowed it to exist so that we can savor moments and we can savor the things that happen in those moments, like tasting chocolate and falling in love and painting a picture and listening to music, creating music. What Vera discovered was, again, a symptom of what is really going on in the universe. And the amazing thing is that had she not taken those observations, we would have assumed, we would have based experiments and facts and theories on axioms that were not true. They were fables. What we saw as the visible matter of the universe was not the entire universe by a long shot. There's a lot going on around us that we can detect as human beings, but we deny its existence because we cannot sense it with an instrument. We cannot gather data on it. And believe me, I was one of them. I was one of them. If that data didn't exist, then I still have a hard time. Even though I've seen some, I have a hard time believing that UFOs are there. I have a hard time resolving the idea that they are here, and yet they do not make their presence known in a big way. I have a hard time realizing that there are forms of communication that go well beyond time, and that communication can be in forms of hugely condensed amounts of energy. Not the basic building blocks, but the entire formed thought, formulas, figures, diagrams, schematics, relationships, as whole pieces of data. And it is up to us to crunch that in our minds and try to figure out how it was put together. How do we do that? We do that through meditation. We do that through thinking about those things. It is the noise of this world, this 3D world. No, it is an illusion. It is not an illusion. But collectively, we have made it into a physical playground that has gotten so noisy, and there's so much sand being thrown around, and there's so many big kids standing up and saying, I'm the leader. No, I'm the leader. No, I'm the leader. That our existence here on this planet has gotten so filled with three-dimensional clutter that we cannot focus. We have lost the ability to focus on these higher dimensional ideas and concepts. What I would like you to try to do is at least for 5 or 10 minutes a day, tune out those things. Turn the radio off in the car while you drive to work, or put some kind of music on the radio that doesn't have a rhythm, that's atmospheric or ambient, something that would allow your mind to drift. No, don't take your mind off the road as if something could do it more than texting. For crying out loud, stop texting and driving anyway. It's killing me. I have to honk at people at green lights all the time because the light goes green 6, 7, 8 seconds, and I realize their forehead is aimed at the floorboard while they're texting, and they're not looking at the light. And what's worse, they're probably rolling down the road doing the same thing. Well, I'm telling you, 5 or 10 minutes while you're driving, thinking about these deep things. You know when I like to do it? I like to do it when I'm riding my motorcycle. You know why? For one thing, I can't listen to the radio. I can't be distracted by anything other than my own thoughts. The other thing is that you're going 70 miles an hour, and air is being forced up your nostrils and circulating in your lungs, and before you realize it, you realize you're scarcely breathing because fresh air is circulating up your nose, down into your lungs, and back out again, and it's more like two-wheeled meditation. Add to that the idea that you're bathing your body in ions as you're zooming down the road like that, the sensation of moving through the air is a lot like flying, and the fact that you have to bank into the corners is a much neater sensation than turning the wheel of a car while you're sitting in an air-conditioned living room. You get the idea. I'm telling you that drive time can be think time, okay? Use the time that you have and be smart. Now, I caution you, don't use the 18th breath while you're driving. I promise you, I've tried it. It's dangerous. Your consciousness, your conscious mind will separate from your body, and your body will be running in unconscious. You can't drive a car while you're unconscious. Oh, your eyes are open. You might be seeing the lines on the road and the freeway signs going by, but if you do the 18th breath, you can crash your car because you will not be able to respond to what's going on around you. You can't get back in time. You can't get back in time, and roads are not that straight, people. Don't do the 18th breath while you're driving. But you can put yourself in a meditative state in the beginning of the day and use that resonance to listen to the universe. Listen to the effects of that you are having with your energy in your universe, in your reality. And if you don't like what's coming back, you can change it. You can go back in the past and you can change it. You can go out into the future and you can place dreams. You can make it work. Also, stay aware that these energies are bringing information into our realm. I can tell you this because I meet a lot of them. I speak to a lot of them. I read their books. And guess what I see? These are independent thinkers, people. They're sitting down with their laptops and their PCs, and they're writing books, and they're struggling, and they're getting them published. And guess what they're saying? Pretty much the same thing. Yeah. They're picking up on the same thing, and depending upon their skills and the aptitude that they've collected with their life, they approach it from a little different point of view. I'm telling you, the information is pouring over the earth right now, and the fact that we're connected together with this giant neural network called the internet, I'm speaking to you right now over it, you're listening to it right now over it, is a testament that we can reconnect ourselves as a being, and we can begin to think as one, or we can at least begin to intend as one. Yes, I want you to keep having your independent thoughts. No, I don't want you to give up your will to anyone. Keep it. But if you don't like your life condition, change it. Now, what does this have to do with space weather and clouds and all that? Well, it has a lot to do with it because the earth itself is going through these changes. The earth itself is responding to these energies that are coming into our realm. The atmosphere is responding. The temperature of the earth is responding. The wildlife of the earth is responding. And we, as humans, are responding to it. Now, I don't mean to pay attention to the political Felder garb that's out there. Yeah, Felder garb is a word that came from the old Battlestar Galactica back in the late 70s. I don't mean to listen to that because there are certainly political opportunists out there who will take advantage of any method of destabilization and try to make themselves wealthy or powerful or famous because of it. I don't mean that. What I mean is how you interact with the earth, because after all, that's what it's all about. That's maybe the whole reason we're here, is that we are with the earth at this time in greater numbers and greater consciousness and greater oneness than we have ever been. And that can make a big difference. So as we think about the confusion of these mainstream scientists, and we think about not the lack of data, but the plethora of data that blows away the old ideas and the old theories of who we are, what this planet is. Are we alone in the universe? Is there randomness to the universe? No, there's great design to the universe. And did you see what this wonderful Hispanic computer programmer did? He allowed computer chaos to run its course. He just put all of the raw materials in. He put the visible and invisible dark matter into the equation and let it run. And what happened? Order arose out of chaos. Order arose out of chaos. That's what I'm trying to tell you. The universe is what it is because it's the only kind of universe that can form. And there are other universes just like ours. And they're moving energy and thus information back and forth. We are much more spectacular consciousnesses than we give ourselves credit for. And as I said, we're here in greater numbers, we're here in greater density, we're here in greater oneness than ever before with a planet that is beginning to go through this change. We're arriving at a point of great concentration. And that's a powerful rendezvous in space and time. So that took me a little bit longer than what I thought. I wanted to make the point thoroughly. I want you to be able to go back and listen to it again and again and try to understand what point I was trying to make there with the idea that science is perhaps a little fabulistic. Not fatalistic, fabulistic. That depending on what set of data gets published, especially on the history, the science, or Discovery channels, and how many people watch it, how popular it was, what star power was applied to it, perhaps it gains a little more acceptance in the mainstream, and then the fable changes. Oh, yes, that's the way we used to believe, but we're smart now. We now know much more, so we can be a lot more intelligent about it. People, that was 3 years ago. Yeah, that was still in the after the turn of the century. Like 2006, 2007, we weren't smart then. We were stupid in the 1990s. We were silly in the 1970s. Come on, people. Science is fabulistic. Go with what your gut tells you, and you know that I'm right. All right, we'll take a quick 40-second break, and then let's talk about HARP. Be right back. Don't go away. More X Squared Radio coming right after this. No, I'm not the only one having computer problems tonight. You are too. Your hard drives are doing weird stuff. Your computers are fairly modern, fast, tons of RAM. Mysterious stuff going on out there. My GPS made me go around the block 4 times today. It had no idea where I was. Strange stuff going on out there. Weird electromagnetic signals upsetting everything. This hour of X Squared Radio, I would like to discuss HARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project, and what may be a symptom of its overuse. Stephen Bryant recalls millions of blackbirds fly over every night. You look up at the sky and it's just black. And then last night at about 10:30, I came out here and I saw a bird drop. Well, in a matter of hours on New Year's Eve, thousands of birds fell from the sky to their death. Melissa Weatherly says, I immediately called Mom because I had to go to work. I said, you have to come get the kids and get the dog because I don't know what's going on. She continues, it was horrible. You could not even get down the road without running over hundreds. It was that bad. Well, I had to read the story because we have had reports of birds dropping with extreme numbers all around the world by the millions and in sudden and catastrophic manners. Why? There's no sign of disease. There's no sign of stress or trauma from extreme winds or hail or shocking weather changes or lightning. My producer writes me, a girl I know in Southern California saw it too. So I should have done it with a Valley accent too. And in Australia, the same thing. And in Eastern Tennessee, the same thing. We have seen evidence of this before. When thousands of blackbirds, different kinds of birds, drop stiff-legged from the sky during a measured harp pulse. You see, ham operators can pick up that pulse, and they report the telltale 2-meter frequency pulse coincided with the massive dying of these blackbirds. Now, they've gathered a lot of them up. Oh, they're going to do autopsies on them. They'll look them over. But people, think about it. You got a couple hundred thousand blackbirds up there in the sky. If they're sick, if they've caught some kind of blackbird flu or whatever, they don't fly. They roost, and they drop from the limb to the ground. I've owned birds. You've owned birds. That's what they do. When they're sick, they don't fly. These were healthy birds flying in the sky, moving like a school of fish in the air. You've seen them. They just fell out of the sky. Not one or two, thousands of them. They covered the roads. They covered the streets. They covered rooftops. They fell in swimming pools. They didn't glide to the ground. They dropped dead in mid-flight. This is the kind of thing we saw from HAARP. We have many times since the mid-80s recorded moments when the death of birds has coincided with these HAARP impulses. Is this the same thing? We're still gathering some evidence to see if there's a correlation, but I can tell you, I am not a fledgling at this. As you know, I built a scale model of HAARP, and I demonstrated it on camera on the History Channel and on True TV with Jesse Ventura. I built it twice. I demonstrated it twice on television, and it worked. The demonstration was to show how weather could be modified with the system in Alaska. I used the same frequencies. I used the same power ratios. I built a cloud chamber. I formed a nice stable cloud, and I disintegrated it, moved it, slapped it around the inside of that chamber like a daisy smack with a 9-iron, and I did it on live TV. I first found out about the HAARP system from Nick Begich. Dr. Nick Begich is a physician in Alaska. He is the son of Senator Begich from Alaska. I had written a paper back in 1986 on using short waves to explore for oil. I'm sorry, 1996. I actually built the equipment in the early 80s, 1983, and I used it for 7 years to explore for oil and gas with great success, I might add. 55 oil wells without a single miss over a 9-state region, and I was 100% accurate shooting hundreds and hundreds of wells. No, that doesn't mean I found hundreds and hundreds of wells. It means that predictions were accurate. 55 of them, I said there would be oil there, and there was. At the exact depth and the exact thickness and the exact quality that I predicted before a drill bit was ever put to the ground. The other hundreds I predicted would be dry holes. And despite Halliburton's best technology, every single one of them was dry, exactly as I predicted. So, I had the system. I didn't know anything about HAARP in the mid-80s. I built my own equipment because I realized a phenomenon. Yes, I was working in the oil business, and we communicated with long-wave radio antennas. I'm talking the 25-meter band. This is marine radio, not a CB radio. This is a radio that's supposed to go 40, 50 miles over open ocean. Well, these were high-quality radios. We were communicating with each other from vehicle to vehicle, and some of them were handheld units. Well, what I noticed is when we were out in oil fields in Middle Tennessee and Western Kentucky, the oil exists in a little different formation there. It exists in cracks, fissures. Land satellite pictures are normally used to find these subterranean cracks from space. And then you go do seismic on them and you use dowsing and different things like that to try and find the oil. All kinds of what they call doodlebugging had been used. What I realized while we were doing physical work in the oil industry is that occasionally the person with whom I was communicating and myself were within eyesight of each other, literally across a field from each other, less than a mile apart, sometimes less than a quarter of a mile apart. But in between us was the fissure in the ground, sometimes 1,000 feet deep. Guess what? The radios wouldn't work. Didn't matter how loud you scream into the radio, no signal was going out. Well, it was going out, but it wasn't being received. Something was absorbing the entire radio signal. So I thought, well, that's really strange. I'm going to measure that. And so I did. I took a Radio Shack DB meter and I modified it to go into the headphone jack of the radio. And when I pressed the button and sent a white noise signal over to the other radio when we were not over an oil formation, the sound was fine. It was right up there, 0 dB, no problem, sometimes 10 dB. However, when we moved the radios, still depressing the button now, not lifting up, when we repossessioned the radios, where one was either directly over that fissure or the fissure was between us, guess what? Minus 70, minus 80, sometimes even minus 90 dB. The radio signal was completely absorbed into the ground. Well, that clued me into something. So I built a spectrometer using a Radio Shack Color 2 computer, if you must know. That's the only computer we had in those days. Then the Commodore 64 came along. Yes, this is way before PC days, people. So I built a spectrometer, and guess what I found? I found wave patterns that corresponded with the signature of oil. Well, that set me on it right there. So I had to develop a way to focus the radio waves, and I had to develop a way to measure that focus, and I did. And over the next 2 years, I developed a system that I checked against thousands of existing wells. The drill records were already part of the state record. I checked them over and over and over again and developed a system that worked. And I found a set of frequencies that worked very, very well for doing it. I wrote a paper on it. Nick Begich read it. Well, in this paper was also an observation because, as I said, I looked for oil and gas over a 9-state region. One of those states, geotechnically active, Oregon. Upper Midwest. There we were, 1987, Roseburg, Oregon, in the summer. We set up. It was a little foggy that day, not too bad, as typical southern Oregon weather. We set up the equipment, which now we had advanced to a camper in the back of a pickup truck for the base reading unit, because I often made printouts and notes and took images and printed those out to make a record of what we were doing. We didn't have GPS in those days, so we had to use a map and we had to use a laser distance meter and actually survey these locations so that we could get it relative to real estate plots. We were out on a fescue farm, a fescue grass farm up in Oregon, and the mobile broadcast unit was about 2,000 feet away from me, way into the fog, couldn't even see where he was. But I directed him to an area that that looked to be, you know, a good possibility as far as trapping oil and gas because of the geology that was appearing up on the side of the mountain. It was kind of an overthrust area. So we were communicating fine by regular communication radio. And I instructed the operator to turn the broadcast signal on. Now, I had a different setup on my end, a receiving end, that allowed me to measure the focus of the angle. And we took triangulation measurements, and I could tell exactly to the foot, within 12 inches, how deep the formation might be. He turned his broadcast unit on, and my three-quarter ton Ford four-wheel drive pickup with a camper mounted on it rocked and rolled like I was on a trampoline. It was an earthquake. So my operator called me back and said, did you feel that? I said, yeah, I felt that. What was that? Is somebody doing demolition in the area? He said, no, I think it was an earthquake. I turned it on. I felt a loud explosion deep in the earth underneath me. And this ripple went across the fescue field toward you. And by the time it got to me, it was enough to rock a 7,500-pound rig like a toy. Now, had we caused that earthquake? I can't say. Was it coincidental that he turned this unit on, sending a harp pulse directly into the earth, and the earthquake happened within seconds of turning that thing on? Yes, it did. It was coincidental. I made notes of it. I put it in my paper, and that's what Nick Begich read, and that's why he called me. I had no idea in 1987 what that would mean for the future of exposing the HAARP weapons system to the world as perhaps the most dangerous meddling with Earth balances since the nuclear weapons program. That's right. Many people don't know this, but the United States detonated more than 600 nuclear bombs above and below the ground. The Russians did too. It's no surprise that beings from all over the galaxy and perhaps even from other dimensions came here and frequent our skies today. When one of these bombs goes off, it sends ripples through space-time like few events can. I'm sure it rattles the dishes all over the place. The fact that this force is in the hands of babies with such terrible tempers as us must make them nervous indeed. HAARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project, is loading up the ionosphere with energy. We're not the only ones with one. We have one. The Russians have one. The Chinese have one. Other nations are experimenting with them. Ionospheric heaters, they call them. Dr. Bernard Eastland, now dead, actually well before his time, is the man that invented HAARP and filed the 7 patents that belong to the United States Navy. I will explain to you what the 7 patents claim. Very briefly. 1, manipulating the weather. HAARP can be used, has been demonstrated to be used, to manipulate weather. It can move the jet stream by pushing the ionosphere out into space, forming a void. The jet stream moves to fill in that void and thus changes direction. Yes, you can direct weather where you want it to go. You can move clouds. If you don't believe me, watch the History Channel yourself. Watch Weather Warfare episode on the History Channel. If you don't believe me, watch True TV, the first episode of Conspiracy Theories with Jesse Ventura about HAARP. It was the most popular episode of that series. It was the first one that we ran, and that was the one that I built the experiment for. It does work. And I was doing it to explore oil and gas. That's also the second one. It's called Earth Tomography. It's like taking a CAT scan of the Earth, only you're using radio waves instead of sound or magnetic resonance. The third is in germ warfare. Yeah, I know, that's pretty scary stuff. but viruses can be developed that lice in the battle zone on command by using HARP signals. In other words, you burst a germ over the battlefield, have your troops withdraw to a safe distance, turn the HARP waves on the enemy. The macrophages, lice inside the victims, the genetic material in the victims then attacks the cells of that victim, killing them in hours. Yeah, that's one of the inventions. The other is ELF, extremely low frequency communication with submarines. The Marconi effect is the bouncing of AM, amplitude modulated signals, off of the ionosphere over the horizon to communicate with other areas. That was what Marconi demonstrated when he communicated from the east coast of the U.S. to Paris with a radio signal. Well, unfortunately, the ionosphere is rather unpredictable and noisy, and sometimes it bounces and sometimes it doesn't. Well, that's not good enough for the United States Navy. They want to be able to direct the ionosphere so that they can not only bounce these signals the way they want to in very low power, but focus them on precise areas so that they can only communicate with the submarine they're trying to reach and nobody can listen in. And it works. They form parabolic mirrors, parabolic dishes, by pushing the ionosphere 40, 50, 60 kilometers out into space, forming a huge parabolic dome, which these ELF waves can be bounced off of, focused by the phased array that exists in Alaska. And it works. The other is as a focused, high-frequency, extremely high-power radio wave to disrupt electronics. It can also be used to carry ELF, ULF, these are ultra-low frequency waves, that can entrain mental processes with human beings. And believe me, many, many experiments have been done with trying to carry messages, audio, visual, and even feelings directly into the human brain using these types of waves. We use it in the battlefield today. Yes, we do. We use HARP on mobile units in the battlefield as what we call non-lethal weaponry today. We turn it on, and it causes those in the field to lose control over their bodily functions. They develop uncontrollable diarrhea within minutes. Within hours, they're weak as kittens, and you go in and clean up the mess. And it functions. It was used in the first Gulf War to demoralize the troops that were holed up in almost bulletproof bunkers that were buried in the sand. Sand is almost impregnable by ordinary conventional weaponry. There just simply wasn't enough bunker-busting technology in those days to take care of all those bunkers that had been built over a 40-year period deep in the desert between Kuwait and Iraq. And so they used HARP, and they kept these men up for a month with nightmares, anxiety, jitters, sleeplessness. And when the tanks began rolling in, not a shot was fired. They poured out by the tens of thousands with their hands over their heads, crying and saying, please, no more of that. HARP, all seven systems have been used and are well-developed and well-powered. I will say that when I was using and developed this technology on my own, I was using less than 50 watts. 50 watts. The final weapon system that HARP can do is to do exactly what we did in Oregon by accident. They can trigger an earthquake. Not if an earthquake isn't already set up in the ground. Those stresses already set up like a giant rubber band stretched to the max. All it needs is a trigger. All it needs is the resonance and the power behind it to make that earthquake trigger and release its energy. And HAARP can be used to do that. Now, the strange thing is that there's a side effect from this, and this is why I responded with supporting the documentary with a section on what's called the ionospheric breakdown or a solar tap. This was the 1997 documentary produced by Wendy Robbins and I can't remember the lady that funded it. She's lives on Ocean Boulevard in California. I'll get her name here in a little bit. It was directed by Wendy Robbins. She's an award-winning documentary director. That documentary is called Holes in Heaven. It was produced in 1997. It's still a top seller around the world. If you haven't seen it, you should see it, because that is the documentary that shook the world. Holes in Heaven. It's based on the book Angels Don't Play This Harp, which was written by Gene Manning, former representative from the state of Alaska, and Dr. Nick Begich. He has since produced several other books which have a lot of this more recent data and more recent commentary from myself in them. So as we wrap up this hour, I want your comments on HAARP. I know you've heard a lot of hype about it, but you haven't really talked to the experts about it. So if you want to call in and talk to one, I'm here. While the energy is sent up, the ionospheric tap means that energy is looking for a way down. The very HAARP path might be that way down. Like throwing Benjamin Franklin's string on a kite, the ionosphere has no way to discharge all that energy. It just sits there, charged up like a battery, pulsating. The HAARP beam may form the ground wire where it is looking for Earth. And if that happens, here's what you could see. This is what you'll see demonstrated in the documentary. Of course, it's an animation, because if it were really to happen, well, it could be the ability to actually end life on this planet as we know it. High atmospheric bolt, a lightning bolt. Not the size of your arm, like the lightning bolt you see in the night sky or the cloudy afternoon jumping a few thousand feet from the bottom of a 50,000-foot cloud to ground. No, not like that. We're talking a high atmospheric bolt the size of Rhode Island. That's how big the bolt would be. Several kilometers in diameter. It would pulse like a thunderbolt. Now, we're not talking about a simple jump 3,000, 4,000, 5,000 feet from the bottom of a cloud to the ground. No. We're talking about 40, 50 kilometers to the ground. It's a much longer distance, a much higher resistance, a much greater potential. That's the difference between the voltage that's in the ionosphere and the ground potential of Earth. The voltage is much higher. Like a thunderbolt, about 10 to 40 times a second, it would pulse. Each pulse would vaporize about 6 inches of solid matter in its way. Rock, water, buildings, trees, everything into pure energy. Each pulse, and I'm talking about 10 to 40 times a second now, each pulse would be something like 50 Mount St. Helens volcanoes going off all at once. It would continue to pulse until the entire ionosphere lost enough energy to be overcome by the resistance of the distance between it and the Earth. That means it could last for several seconds. It could last for several minutes. The amount of particulate matter blown up into the atmosphere would block the sun for a decade. And perhaps plants would survive. Most animals would not. The ozone layer would be gone for at least 25 years. This is the downside of using HARP. Not to mention, every time they fire it up and focus it, if there are animals in the way, they're going to get killed. That's why thousands of birds fall perfectly healthy out of a flying sky, flying along, minding their own business, looking for something with which to breed. They fall out of the sky dead. Heart stopped, brainwave stopped. They fall to the ground like a brick. We'll pick it up the next hour. More X Squared Radio coming after this. We'll listen to a little Muse Uprising. All right, welcome back to X Squared Radio, Hour 3, January 2011, coming to you live from southern Mississippi. By the way, our AccuWindow forecast is 39 degrees and clear. First 2 hours, we covered weather weirdness and what could be causing it. Our sun, other forces in the galaxy, other forces in the universe. Interesting stuff. We're glad that they're putting out some of that information like that. It lets us get, you know, 10 or 15 minutes of expert opinion without any cross-examination, of course. And we'd love to get them to come on the program, but they never respond, so... We interview them anyway. And then the second hour, we talked about HARP, the High Frequency Active Auroral Research Project. If you missed that hour, please go back and listen to the archive. If you're not an archive listener, that's easy to fix. Go to xsquaredradio.com and click on the subscribe button. You will make for yourself a username and password. You can buy a month's worth of unlimited access for $2.50, or you can buy a whole year's worth of access. So you can access it at work while you're working on your favorite project. A lot of people do that. Or you can download it to your iPod or your other favorite listening device. They're all MP3s. And you can listen to them while you're walking around or while you're driving. Great entertainment. We try to keep the sound quality as high as we can. Or if you want the fast version, you can go to bbsradio.com and listen to all 3 hours in one big segment and click on the archives and become a subscriber at BBS Radio. Certainly get access to tons more hosts than you do here because I'm the only host here. But do what you want to do. If either way, it kind of helps keep the lights on, but... We get to pay our bill directly if you subscribe. Subscribe to both. It's less than a cost of a bag of popcorn, and it's for a good cause, ours. We try to do it as a hobby, but certainly is nice to help keep the lights on. Also, don't forget, Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. If you're not already a reader, you should go to rememberingthefuturebook.com. And you should pick up the Kindle version, the Nook version, the audio version, or the hard copy paperback version, which will come autographed by me. And in doing so, in buying the paperback version, you will get the audio version for free as a bonus. So you'll get that while you're waiting for the paperback to arrive in the mail. And that way you can listen to the whole book. And even if you're not a great reader, don't worry about it. I read it for you. If you have already read the book, why not start off the new year, because we are now in 2011, and the book has great application for those who are trying to prepare themselves in other ways for 2012. Some of the book was written in the year 2015. Yes, it's Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. So there is some time travel involved in the book. I think you'll enjoy the entertainment of it, but you'll also enjoy the application of it, because this is a self-help, spiritual, motivational book from a physicist's point of view. Yes, there's a little bit of math in it, but we try to make it simple enough that even the average high school student can grasp it. And if you can't, write me. Lots of people do. And ask me questions all the time, and that's what I want to talk about in this hour. We're going to talk about some of the questions that people have, not only about time travel, but also about the application of the human energy in the human condition of mortality here on the Earth. Not only its effect on the planet itself, but perhaps on the universe, and certainly on the total consciousness of mankind. And some of the questions are pretty poignant. Some of the questions are really deep thinking. I got a great set day before yesterday and answered back. So those of you that have written me already know that I answer every single email. Yes, it might take me a day or two. And yes, I'm busy, but I have my priorities as well. And, you know, when I write a book and get it out there and I have people coming back and saying, what about this? What about that? What does this mean? What does that mean? I want to respond to it. I want that energy of the response to go out there, the karma of the response to go out there. And more than that, I want the solution to be put into the hands of the person that asked the question. Because if one person wrote me, 50 people are asking about it. And if you have such a question and you want to ask it, go ahead and bring it up now or any of the other things we've talked about tonight. So let's get started with that. Let's see. Where do we start? Wayne from Indiana on line one. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Dr. Agnew. Actually, that's Idaho. And thank you.
Idaho. Idaho's way different than Indiana. How could I mix those two up?
Well, you're right. It is way different. Boy, this information that you've been giving about HARP, I've heard about a lot of things about HARP, but this is new. And it's certainly concerning, especially considering how responsible or irresponsible those people might be that are using it.
Yes, well, if you saw the special that Jesse Ventura did, he went up there as not only the former governor of Minnesota, but also as the host of True TV. And, you know, Jesse's no fledgling. He's not to be trifled with. He couldn't get past the gate. And it was a test of wills there for a while. They're not giving out any information except the official tour, when, of course, it's not operating.
Right, and whatever information they give out, well, it's certainly going to be a spin. I have a question, though. If this is what's killing the birds, it's indeed very powerful. How do we know that they are not using that where perhaps a private plane might fly through? And what would it do to the occupant in that plane?
Well, they actually have experimented with that on drones. They haven't knocked down planes that have passengers in them because they can focus this. This doesn't get out of hand. They know where all the airplanes are. Every N number that's in our airspace, every plane that's in airspace anywhere, they know where it's at. That's not to say that small aircraft haven't been knocked out, because it will fry the electronic ignition. And believe me, passenger planes and especially the small aluminum beer cans that you fly around with the air-cooled engines definitely do not have hardened electronics. And they will not take a multi-billion watt signal aimed at the electronics. And they have knocked drones out of the sky. And they've even used it to take missiles off path. They're trying to set up a high-frequency radio shield, like a missile shield, over the country, at least to make it less of a numbers game for anyone who's thinking about, you know, barraging the United States with a debilitating ballistic missile strike.
Well, then it's certainly not inconceivable that small private plane or a crop duster or something like that could have passed through that beam, and lo and behold, it was the cause of an otherwise unknown cause of a crash.
Well, the pilot usually isn't around to say, hey, everything in my cockpit went dark. I couldn't even pick up the radio and call the airport because every electronics in the plane was fried.
No, you're right. That's right. They probably didn't survive it.
Well, you know, and the birds, you know, it just fries their little brains, and their hearts quit pumping, and their wings just stop flapping in mid-flight, and they fall like a brick to the ground. They don't fall on the ground flopping, you know, like something knocked them out of the sky. They fall like a lump of feathers.
Well, that much power, that's frightening.
Well, it is frightening, and that's why activists like Nick Begich and myself and Patrick Flanagan and Gene Manning and dozens of others have been screaming in an official way, not you know, banging pots and pans out on the mall in Washington, D.C., for some oversight, some civilian oversight. You know, I don't think anybody has as much experience as my crew did using HAARP signals to explore for oil and gas. We pioneered it. We built the system. And to not ask us what could be the side effects of using huge amounts of power behind these frequencies is just irresponsible.
Well, and a bit egotistical too, I think. Is there any easing up on the side of HAARP to come forward with some of this information, or to say, well, we are doing this and this and this to be, you know, to be responsible, to be careful?
As true to form, normally these research projects, as this is one, they normally have grad students or low paid experts in the field working on those projects. They do it to build their own resumes. It's pretty much the same at all the government facilities. If you go up to the Hanford Laser Interferometer Gravitational Wave Observatory, there are some career scientists there. Certainly the mechanical, chemical, and physics engineers that are up there have been there a number of years. But the non-salaried ones, the ones that actually go out and speak to the public, are generally not professionals. They're academics. And true to form, when we see them interviewed, when they actually come out to the fence and answer questions like, you know, what about this weapon system? What about this coincidence that we're measuring these HAARP signals because ham radio operators are picking up the radio waves, and then we have these effects happen? And they speak as though they have no clue. If you look at some of the documentaries, it's quite frightening, some of the responses that they come up with. It's incriminating, almost, their ignorance of it. Now, when the government professionals come out, the actual agents, the Navy guys that are running it, they know the official line, and they're quite forceful about it. But when you talk to the research people, the spokesman, it's quite a different story. It's embarrassing.
Well, that's just wonderful. Well, if you have time, I'd like to jump to a different question.
Sure.
Okay. Earlier, you were talking about the voltage, the energy that's in the atmosphere, and certainly the space shuttle years ago made a test that proved that as well.
Right, the tether experiment.
Yes, that's it, the tether experiment. Do you know what the volt per meter or volt per foot is as we would go up?
You know, that's a good question. It's a function of the velocity. The space shuttle travels at about between 200 and 240 miles in altitude. It travels at a speed of between 14 and 17,000 miles an hour. This tether was a Kevlar fiber that had metal in it in order to try to pick up what they thought was going to be microwatts of energy. However, it was designed to take about 12,000 volts per foot. And when they extended the tether, now keep in mind, this is just a drag line. It's just let out because they're trying to test what's called the dynamo effect. The dynamo effect is that when you move ions past a piece of metal, it induces a current flow in it. And they wanted to see if there was a dynamo effect up there. And they had no idea what to expect, but they built for what they thought were the conditions. When they let the tether out, and of course it wasn't a straight line, it was kind of a squiggly string hanging out behind the space shuttle. When they connected it, it exploded because it had way, way more than 12,000 volts per foot, probably more like 500,000 volts per foot. And that's what just exploded the tether. It just vaporized.
Well, earlier in this program, you were talking about the energy that, if this conduit were opened up, could come as a huge lightning bolt down to the Earth. And I was thinking, my thought was it was the same energy that the shuttle was measuring. Is that incorrect?
Yeah, because the ionosphere is a different layer. It is about 40 to 60 kilometers up, and the space shuttle is up around 200 miles, well beyond the ionosphere. The way the upper atmosphere layers out is sometimes a little difficult to understand, but the space shuttle doesn't exactly fly through matter, so to speak. It's so light that there's no friction on the space shuttle at all. In order for it to steer, they have to use pulse rockets, which are basically powder that is shot through a catalyst, and it instantly explodes. So it doesn't even have to have an ignition, a source of ignition. So that's how they move around up there. The powder can be stored very safely without the catalyst in its presence for long periods of time in great amounts of density. So it can be used for weeks and weeks and weeks, to steer and make minor adjustments to the craft. So there's nothing flowing over the space shuttle that any of the control surfaces like the rudder or elevators or anything would have an effect on. So they're basically in open space, well above what we would consider our atmosphere.
Earlier, though, in the show, you were talking about energy or a voltage, and I've completely misunderstood it, but a voltage that was in the atmosphere, and then you referred to the Rhode Island sized lightning bolt.
Well, that was two separate segments. The voltage that was induced in the atmosphere was from these electric currents generated in the atmosphere by these high energy particle explosions that occur out in space. The one segment that we played, they expected to find these explosions along the galactic plane in line with the galaxy. They weren't. They were from literally a cloud of them scattered all around. So it meant that these energy pulses were many orders of magnitude bigger than what was expected in the first place. But what was least expected was their distribution, their even distribution across the sky. It leads us to believe that there's a power source out there. It may not be continuous. It might be pulsing. But it is well beyond what we expected to be out there. How do we tap into it? I think you'd have to have a pretty good size antenna to actually concentrate it and, you know, flow it into something like a battery or an energy grid. But it's definitely there, and it does induce a current flow in our upper atmosphere and in our lower atmosphere where we of course reside.
I see. Okay, and actually that's the last question I was going to get to was, would there be an energy source there? So I appreciate that. And apparently I blended a couple of things that you said earlier. But thanks for putting that up
it's
for me.
It's easier to do. I have a hard time separating it in my mind, too. But, you know, there have been some people that have stretched long runs of wire around poles on large pieces of property and connected them together as a circuit. And they pick up several hundred volts pulsed into that and store it with batteries and use it. Of course, it does take a lot of wire, and it takes a lot of care in putting that out there, keeping the wires separated and keep birds from lighting on them and putting the poles in the ground. But it can be done, and I'm not saying that a big grid couldn't be put out there, you know, in the desert or in the mountains and just gather electricity right out of the air. Of course, it could be done. Absolutely. It's DC. But it's definitely usable.
Well, maybe it's something that could happen sometime. Well, Dr. Agnew, thank you for taking my call and clearing this up for me.
Ah, thanks so much, Wayne. Thanks for calling. I love Idaho. I've spent some time out there.
Yes, just a year or two ago, you were saying that you lived in, goodness sakes, over by the river
The teeming metropolis of Glen's Ferry.
That's it.
Yes, down there by the Snake River. Gorgeous country. Absolutely phenomenal sunrises and sunsets. Amazing stars, too. All right, Wayne, thanks for calling. Call back anytime and listen closely.
Will do. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Good night. And, you know, any of you others that that want to call in, sorry, I didn't get to the others on the line there. Feel free to call back. Now the lines are open. I get long-winded sometimes answering questions, and I apologize, but I promise to be just as long-winded answering yours. So go ahead and call back, or you can Skype me. You can send me a chat message. I'm at X2-radio if you want to do a search for that. It'll come up somewhere on Earth. Not exactly sure what the location is, but you'll be able to find me. Excuse me while I clear my throat. Had to hit my cough button there really quick. As we wrap up this hour, we've got about 25 minutes in this hour. Give my producer plenty of time to get the next host on. I want to cover a couple more things with respect to mixing, you know, the human energy with all the galactic energy that's out there. This is pretty fascinating stuff because there's an energy exchange that's going on. Actually, raw information is being fed into the minds, I should say consciousnesses, of everything on Earth, every rock, every rill, every blade of grass, every animal. And everything responds differently to this energy. Some of it resonates with a light sympathetic energy. And some of it picks it up based on the aptitude of that individual consciousness, be it a dolphin or a human being, with a different result. We get pictures, images, feelings, and we convert that into music and books and works of art, and it affects our emotions. We should know that those effects are out there. Whether you want to be affected by the universe or whether you want to affect the universe is up to you. Okay, let's go back to the phones. Joe from Idaho, you're on line one. Welcome to the program.
You have another Joe. I would like you to know that my people are the de jure sovereign in Idaho. My great-grandfather built the first road into the first Idaho capital in Albion, which is just kind of southeast from Glens Ferry.
Oh, how about that? And there's some amazing stuff. They found stuff like, I don't know, 15 million years old there, handmade.
Yeah, there's a lot of interesting history. I live most of my life in the Salmon area, and the Sheep-Eater Indians have some quite interesting petroglyphs in there, too, or, you know, things that they have written, the Sheep-Eater Indians did.
Yeah, it's amazing
stuff. It's an awesome country. It's my homeland. I have been watching it be gated off and taken over.
Yeah, it's interesting how land becomes private property, isn't it?
Yeah, not only our land, but our thoughts. I mean, they tell us how to think anymore, and if we don't do that, we're not normal.
You know? Yeah, what is it? Idaho is like 42% owned by the federal government? It's
really, Lemhi County is 72%, and I'm up near the St. Mary's area now. I've been up here
Idaho
for several years now. Since 2004, I sold down by Salmon.
Ah, well, you have some of the best stars in the country, I'll tell you that. I love the
stars. Yeah, and I've been seeing some interesting things, and I wanted to talk to Mr. Nikoloff when he was on, because I saw something going clear across the horizon a week ago today that had no wings on it. I could see tail fins, but no wings on this thing. It looked like what I would think a missile looks like, but it went clear across, looked like it was headed towards maybe Vancouver, Canada direction.
My goodness, was it high overhead or low in the horizon?
No, it was fairly low. Now, I've seen some interesting things the more I look up, way up high with lights and streaks of lights and then bright flashes and then some turning and taking off and some outrunning others when they're following in a direct line, one behind the other.
Yeah,
so I'm really amazed at the signs in the heavens and in the earth these days.
Have you tried the night vision stuff up there yet?
No, I can't afford that kind of thing.
Yeah, I know what you mean. I know. Well, sometimes you can run across somebody that has it, but there's a lot more going on up there than people think. And if you just we were occupying a 90,000 square foot building there as we were doing some research and development work, and And the building outside had a wonderful roof that you could lay down on your back. And that and way, the sand fleas and thorns that blow around there wouldn't bother you. But you could get hours of awesome night vision, you know, scanning of the skies.
That's one good thing about Idaho until these chemical trails. And this brings me kind of to the questions I have. I happen to be listening on something on television, and it's been a year or so ago. Since then, I've shut television off. I watch no more television. I told Dish Network that I didn't want them anymore. But it was talking about a cloud and connecting internet or somewhat similar through a cloud, and they called it a cloud, that it would be a cloud, and through this cloud it would get rid of basically individual servers. It would. So I kind of wonder if chemical trails and maybe even related to HARP technologies might have something to do with that. And if you knew anything about it. And also I was wondering about these spirals. There were spirals, one in Norway and one in off of Australia, and then another in China. And the one in Norway, a lot of people seem to think this is some great anomaly, but it looks like there's something coming from the ground when you look at the video from it. So I wonder whether that has to do with...
I think the official line was that that spiral seen over Norway was a rocket that got away from the Russians and went into a death spiral up into the sky. And lots of people photographed it, and boy, they just, I mean, everything from an interdimensional portal opening up to, you know, some kind of ray being directed at the Earth. I don't know. You know, the official Russian line is, hey, we launched a rocket, the gyros went bad, and the darn thing went into a death spiral up there, and that's what you see.
I don't believe that, and it doesn't explain the one in Australia or the one in China either. So,
yeah, I don't think the Australians were launching missiles.
It looked like to me in the one photograph you could definitely see some type of beamed energy either going to the ground, all the way to the ground, or up to the spiral. So I was a little curious about that. And the other thing I was curious about was whether these this HARP technology, whether it can be used as a missile defense to heat up maybe a 30-kilometer diameter area using whatever chemical trails. I have a really, really bad feeling about these chemical trails, and I think that somehow they are connected in some ways with HARP, and not only for weather. And I kind of suspected these birds dying on maybe something like that. They have been spraying us really badly for the last several years. And actually, when I went to the Idaho Attorney General's office by phone, telling them I had times, dates, and places that they were spraying us, and with video that showed that it blocked out the sun by the end of the day, I was arrested 2 weeks later. So, but we don't want to go into that right now. But it also brings me back to another thing, is that when you get to be a pain in their tail end so badly, how important do you have to be before they start making you angry and screaming and wondering what you're going to do about things?
Well, we just kind of try to keep the lights turned on, you know. I find that they can't do works in darkness if you just keep the lights turned on. And once
I'm
people
on
start
my knees, and that's about the only light I know to get. And I'm sorry for interrupting.
Well, I was just going to say, if as soon as you start ignoring it and start being apathetic about it, that's when they start doing their dirty work. And it's even the same, you know, in your local city council. If you go to the city council meetings once a month and you make them and listen, yeah, it's pretty boring. It's kind of a waste of time, you think. Stop
Actually,
going.
I make a bigger stir than half my community through the courts and county commissioners and such.
Well, stop going and watch what happens. That's when your taxes go up. That's when land gets annexed. That's when eminent domain gets implemented. That's when city council members start their shenanigans, having new projects that are paid for with taxpayer dollars built on worthless property that they've owned for years. that they're able to sell to the city for 50 times.
I see that it makes them harder to get away with some things, but when you're alone and there isn't enough people to stand up with you, it makes you a target where they take your children and they take your machinery and they throw you in a cage or murder you. And
I have heard about that.
And I won't go into detail on that kind of thing, except for that this is my homeland. And I've said this on this radio network before, my children were born in Ukraine. And over there, when there's a bare piece of land in the railroad right-of-ways or on the road right-of-ways or in the off places, people just grow their garden there. But in Idaho, where I'm born and raised, I see one more gate after the other being built. And here we call it wild animals sport and game. And we run our four-wheelers all over the hillside so that we think we have to have these gates. But over there, when people have enough to feed their family, which is, they're struggling because the bankers already dismantled their system over there, they take their food down to the bazaar or on the street and sell it just out on the street. And police might come along and take a little bit because they're starving too, and they'll protect them from the tax collectors and the thugs and the mafia and whatever. And there are no genetically modified foods, and there are no pesticides, and there are no herbicides. And I come back to my homeland here in Idaho, and I tell people about the differences between here and there. I see good and bad. I see them both as a police state. But they say, well, we still live in the most free country in the world. But when we look into it, our birth certificate, given by an informant or a mother, spelt in back-ass words, last name first name last, all in capital letters, is registered with the Treasury Department and put on file at the U.S. Deposit Trust Corporation, where it's sold as a bond over and over and over again. And we are literally born into bondage. And entities like China not only think they own everything our great-grandchildren will ever produce, but that they own them themselves. And so I worry about my homeland, and I worry about the skies, these chemical trails I'm very worried about, and the HAARP technologies. And it seems like these birds have coincided with numbers of earthquakes going on. So I wondered whether they're a new missile defense shield also that isn't being talked about. I kind of wondered about that and the computer.
I think HAARP, one of the inventions is that it is a missile defense shield because it can be directed at the missiles, which obviously cannot carry enough, you know, lead or high density metal to protect themselves because they got to fly. They just make use of their speed and their element of surprise as their primary weapon. And if HAARP can be fired up, which it can be in just a few minutes, it can be directed at these electronics and foul up their direction systems, and then missiles just become loose cannons then, and may not even detonate. They may just fall to the ground unarmed. But the symptoms that we see, birds falling to the ground and dolphins floating up dead, whales becoming disoriented and beaching themselves, not in small numbers, in large numbers, fish getting disoriented, insects not making their way back to the hive. This comes from electromagnetic interference, not in small amounts, in very high power, concentrated amounts.
Well, it appears that when I look at some graphs that we're losing our electromagnetic field around the Earth and that we are becoming more maybe susceptible to CMEs and such things. I'm wondering if that may have something to do with that, and I don't know anything about this. I wish I would have had an opportunity to study and research science more.
Well, we monitor this on a pretty regular basis. Every week we report on the proton count, and it stays normally between 1 and, you know, 4 protons per cubic centimeter. But I will say a couple weeks ago, it got up higher. It got up close to 13 protons per cubic centimeter, and I've never seen it that high. I've been monitoring it for years. So we are seeing spikes of protons that have nothing to do with sunspots or solar flares. They're coming from somewhere else.
I see. And this, you don't think that this that HAARP can be used to heat up particles that they put out that are sprayed in the upper atmosphere, in our lower atmosphere, in the troposphere here, in the chemical trails to heat up an area to make a missile defense shield that nothing can penetrate?
Well, I'm not sure how that would function, how you would heat up an area to make it, you know, not work against something that's traveling 6,000 or 7,000 miles.
Okay. Yeah, I don't know. I just, that's what the impression I was under was that maybe it was zapping it like a microwave and hitting these particles, whether it was water particles or the barium salts, I don't know, the aluminum, and heating it up so much that nothing could penetrate it.
It could, but I think more likely the electromagnetics is aimed at the wiring and circuitry inside the electronics and causing it to fry.
Hmm. Well, that's very interesting and very informative, and I really appreciate your time, and I'm glad to listen to you.
All right, I appreciate you calling in, Joe. Thanks for listening.
And thank you. Good night.
Talk to you later. Bye-bye. Same to you. And I want to pass that message along to you all, too. This is the 2nd of January, and I do want to wish you all a tremendous new year. You know, 2010, as 2009 ended, we were arriving in Kentucky very strong. We had all the funding we needed to launch the company. We had everything we needed as far as Department of Energy and the state and Commonwealth support and local support, investor support. And in the next 4 months, it was as though it was systematically taken apart from the federal government down. I mean, it was directed, actually, from the Department of Energy. That was disappointing. Yeah, it was frustrating. It was heartbreaking. It was disappointing most of all. Can we get around it? Of course we can. Of course we can. There are hundreds of thousands of people that want the product. And if somebody wants it, believe me, we'll find a way to find private investors because they see a return on investment and it's a great product. Believe me, electric vehicles will sell. And everything that we predicted about fuel costs, $3 a gallon gasoline has come and gone. We're now heading for $4. I would say after by next Christmas or shortly thereafter, we'll be at $5 a gallon. Trust me, I'm not directing it. I'm not manifesting it, but we predicted $100 a barrel oil. We're there. We're in the upper 90s right now. It's not coming back. Because it doesn't serve anybody's interest, not even the leaders of the United States. It doesn't serve anybody's interest to have oil cheap again. It will be $100 barrel oil and up. And if you want to be able to drive back and forth to work every single day reliably with air conditioning, with heat at the rate of 300 miles per gallon, believe me, the product will sell. And that was what was disappointing, to see the year 2010 with all of its hopes of progress, of growth, of job creation, of moving away from foreign oil, evaporate because of the empty promises of a president who could not deliver on what he promised. That was what was most disappointing about 2010. If companies like ours would have just had the money spent on the signs put up in every community, telling those communities that the Reinvestment Act was the source of funds for whatever project was happening in that local community. If they just would have not bought the signs and used the money they spent on putting the signs up and put that into small business, we could have created some jobs. But no, they had to spend the money on putting the signs up telling you that they're doing a good job, which they're not. They're just feeding the money from one multi-billion dollar corporation to another multinational multi-billion dollar corporation, and small business was left behind. We were lied to, and now we're smarter for it. So 2011 will be a different year. We're going to do things differently this year. You watch. You watch. Because we, the people, still run this country. How do we run it? We run it with our checkbooks, people. Where you spend your money is how the economy will go. You want to move away from gasoline as a fuel to get back and forth to work and put another $5,000, $6,000, $7,000 a year tax-free back in your pocket? You know exactly how to do it. Check it out. It's out there, I promise you. The technology is already available. It's already built. It's already driving on the roads. All you have to do is demand it, and it will be yours. We appreciate you being part of X Squared Radio for the last 5 years. We're now starting our sixth year with BBS Radio. Proud to be a member of them and try to deliver a quality program every Sunday between 5 and 8 Pacific. We will work on the sound quality. We'll work on the quality of guests this year and promise you that we will deliver what you demand. Feel free to call or write anytime. My contact information is at x2-radio.com or x2-radio.com. If you can't remember that, put in X Squared Radio in Google. Put in Paranormal Internet Talk Radio. Believe me, X Squared Radio is number one, and you can find us, and you can call us anytime. Don't forget, Remembering the Future, the Physics of the Soul and Time Travel. It's affordable. I think you can get it at Amazon, Barnes & Noble, Books & Million, Borders, Walden Books, everywhere fine books are sold. But if you want an autographed copy and you want the audiobook for free, there's only one place to get it, and that's at rememberingthefuturebook.com, rememberingthefuturebook.com. Tell a friend if you've bought it, if you've listened to it. Spread the word. Let's see if we can't turn this behemoth on its heels with our own intention. The power of a mustard seed applied at exactly the right moment in exactly the right intensity can have amazing effects. We'll see you next week right here on X Squared Radio. It has been a great pleasure to have you here with us this evening. Tell a friend about us, because every Sunday evening at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, we bring you the best 3 hours of exploration into the mysteries of the universe and of the Earth. If you're not getting all 3 hours, send us the call letters of your local station, and we'll do the rest. Remember, Earth Explorers, that you are Source. Everything we do will eventually affect the universe, so try to do it on purpose. Reach out for the good in people and help it to grow a little every day, and before long, you will have saved the planet. This is X Squared Radio saying, peace, Earth Explorers.